Hello and welcome to another episode of At Random. My name is Rick Timmis.
I'm John Wordsworth.
And I'm Jackson Matthews.
On tonight's show, we're going to be taking a look at Ubuntu 11.10, released by Canonical. This release version is called Oniric Ocelot. And John, you've been having a bit of fun with it getting installed.
Indeed. I mean, I think this is... I see this as rebalancing the force after the last episode of At Random, where we had a look at the Windows 8 developer preview.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think it's going to be interesting to see how they match up.
I'm very excited. I've even got sweaty hands, lads. Because, of course, this is a chance for us to do a really in-depth look at a Linux distro. And it's great to be looking at this live with you two guys, because I can really get some feedback at what you're looking at. I know we did Linux PCOS back in an earlier version, but it was only a short look at that. And it's going to be, I'm really excited to look at this and to have some positive things to say. And, of course, I won't say anything negative.
Yeah. One year of podcasting, this is what you've been waiting for, Rick. This is the moment you've been building up to.
So here's hoping it doesn't stink. Well, I don't know, actually. It could be some good heat.
So, well, I think it kind of makes sense to start at the beginning, really, doesn't it? So I installed this before the show. I thought it wouldn't necessarily make for the most exciting show if the first hour was us just sitting here waiting for the install process to chamber through on my pathetic internet connection. But I'll recap a little bit. But very similar to the Windows 8 install that I ran through not so long ago. I mean, obviously it looked very different, but the actual essence of what you go through is very much the same. I mean, you're obviously hit with the do you wish to run from the live CD before you choose to install, which is quite cool. I mean, I've played with Debian before, so I kind of knew that I wanted to have a play with Linux, but if you don't know and you want to give it a try, I can see that live CD feature being really useful for someone who's been told about Linux but doesn't want to commit to it straight away.
Yeah, I mean, that's been kicking around for quite a while now, and it was Klaus Knopper that first developed the kind of live bootable distros with a distribution called Nopix, and been around for 6 or 7 years. Mm. And it really is a great way to be able to non-destructively and non-invasively just load up an operating system, that get to play around with it, pull the DVD or the disc back out of the drive, and away you go back. But also, I'm interested to get your feedback on that paradigm, because the Windows installer will probably boot from the disk and go straight into install mode, whereas the Ubuntu install is to boot into the live distro. I know it gives you options to install, but the default is to boot into the live distro, give you the desktop, and then plonk you an icon saying, do you want to install this to your hard drive? Was that the experience that you got? Did you just allow it to do that default thing?
No, I can't say I did. I mean... I knew what I wanted to do. I played with one of the live CDs quite a few years ago, just because the concept was interesting. But kind of in my head, as I've already played with that, I didn't need to play with it again.
Okay.
So I just hit the install button straight away. But at which point, it became very similar to the Windows install. So select your partition, what's your name, what would you like to call your computer, what time zone are you in? Aha, thank you. I guess a couple of differences that came up along the way. I thought it was really cool the way that after you've gone through the first couple of steps, the files are installing while you're filling out the rest of the process. So while you're answering some of the questions, the little bars going up at the bottom, I thought that's really cool. It's doing it. It's not waiting for my name before it starts the grunt work.
I used to love that on Firefox when I saw it for the first time. And as you were like figuring out where you're going to put this file, it says, hey, I've already got it ready, there you go. And then just get it, and you got it instantly once you clicked all the buttons. I thought that was a little bit of magic.
Yeah, Firefox was the first browser, wasn't it, where you quite often with small files, by the time you've picked the location and the file name, it's already there because it's downloaded the 7 megs or whatever in the background.
Yeah.
So it's kind of that. I mean, obviously, an OS install isn't going to be quite as quick.
Yeah, but
it's nice to know it's a quarter of the way through by the time you finish answering the questions.
Just efficient. It's just attention to detail, little things like that. Just make it a little bit nicer.
It's the polish that matters. You're absolutely right. And little tweaks like that, there's been, a lot of focus on that. There's, I think that, that out there, there's still this legacy belief that, you know, you need to be some kind of uber geek if you want to use Linux, and that it means, you know, getting 18 floppy diskettes and loading them in and, you know, trying to, you know, fiddle around with things at the command line. The experience is not like that at all. It's a very shiny experience these days. So that's, it's nice to see that you picked up on the fact that, you know, it's off, it's getting itself busy whilst it's asking you for the credentials and using that multitasking kind of paradigm.
From what I can make out, it's a very different beast than what I was led to believe Linux was like. I mean, I'd always thought of Linux as something that, I'm never going to be able to get that. The last time I used it, I think I was trying to install it on, a version of it, on the PS3, back when you could still do that.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a hell of a time trying to get anything to work. I mean, I was basically just looking at John, and then he'd just keep telling me what to type into the terminal, a character at a time, because none of the words made any sense to me. It was just moo and v and apt get and all that stuff. I didn't know what any of it was. And I just came to realise that if you type sudo on the beginning of something, then it does it. If you don't, then nothing happens. And that's as much as I know. But since then, I thought to myself, I can't be doing with Linux. But then I found out just how many different versions of it, how many options you had. Like, you didn't necessarily have to go with this one that doesn't necessarily work in this machine. And hopefully, as I see this, I haven't really seen extensively in action, but this Ocelot is going to look much more like an operating system with a shot at the big time. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You were saying, you know, looking at it and looking forward to see it. You know, here's the login screen. Jack, talk to us. What do you see? What do you think from a design point of view?
Well, it's interesting to look at this after having done the Windows 8 one last episode, because this front screen, in a lot of ways, is clearly going for a very. I'm not saying it's copying, because Windows 8 was late to the party, but this is all kind of chasing the same sort of aesthetic. They want to make it as clean and as non-invasive as possible. I mean, we've got that nice mellow hazy coloured background and minimal interface stuff. I mean, we've got like the clock top right in like a semi-transparent bar and just your login box on the left. And for the most part, it's all just whatever picture is going to be better. I don't know if that's customisable or not. Does anybody know?
The login screen is customisable. Yeah. You could put whatever you want there at the background. There's kind of like a sort of the login panel that's there in the centre, and on the left-hand side is almost like a kind of transparent sprite plane that's sitting over the top of the background. So yeah, you can configure that to whatever you like.
It's nice. I like it. It's minimalist. It's tidy, and it's minimalist without looking cheap. It looks stylish. It looks attractive.
Just before we jump in and log in, couple more things about the install process I'd like to highlight. While I think it's kind of 99% of the way there, there were one or two hiccups that I thought could be improved upon. So, I mean, this is obviously something particular to my case, but I found that my poor net connection meant that it took about 2 hours to install. Presumably it's downloading some packages in the background, which was a little bit frustrating, because obviously I downloaded the ISO the day before and burnt the disk in the hope that I wouldn't need a net connection to then install it. But that's just obviously, I'm sure if you've got no net connection, it will probably happily install off the disk. If you have a net connection, it probably downloads some things in the background. Because I have a net connection, it's just rubbish. I suspect I'm in a unique situation there. There was one tiny little bug which I bumped into on the way, and I think I must have entered some data into the fields in a slightly backwards order, but I entered a computer name and it just kept saying that computer name already exists on the network, even when I just mashed the keyboard, and I couldn't get to the next step until that was done. So I eventually found, by sort of going on a different computer online, that you just have to edit one of the other fields on the same panel and then it corrects itself.
Now, did you do anything about that? Because obviously the big thing about Linux and that is the ability to interact with the open source community. And so in an ideal world, what we'd like to see is to see you experience that and then raise a bug.
I would have done, but it was all over the forums. So I assumed it was kind of...
It was already being talked about.
I assume it was widely known. Like when I typed in the phrase that came up, again, which only took a long time because my internet connection sucks. but when I typed that in, there are quite a few forum posts came up about it. So I have no doubt that it's been logged somewhere, because it seemed reasonably common. So. But it didn't seem like it was new. I didn't think it was a... I think what I saw was reference to it in an older version of Ubuntu. But
Right, okay, well, that's an interesting one. Maybe it's not... maybe for some reason it's not got through, been triaged or fixed for whatever reason. It might also be that it might be not having enough priority. It might not be raised enough priority, because I think the use case that you explained was... You went through the fields in an unusual order.
Yeah, because I can never decide what to call my computers, so I left that one till last, which meant I went to the bottom of the form, filled in my username and password, and then went, now, what shall I call my computer?
Mm.
And by doing that box last, that's why it wouldn't... It's like it almost... It doesn't check to see whether it's actually available or not until you go to the next box or something.
Yeah.
So normally you would do that, but because I did it in my own personal order, it wasn't happy. But that was only a minor thing. So,
With the net side of things, you're absolutely spot on. If you install it and there isn't a net connection available, it will install all the packages off of the disk and give you a fully running Ubuntu system with all the stock stuff that you would expect to be installed by default when you install it. The net, what it does, it takes advantage of the network being there and downloads latest release packages, updates, and so on and so forth. So if it can get a newer version or something, it's just going to pull that down and use that instead. So and particularly in the early part of the release cycle like this, you know, there's the chance that there may well be some stuff that can be pulled in and pulled down. So,
but I mean, overall thoughts on the install is there's no reason why you shouldn't give an Ubuntu disk to a Windows user and let them play with it, and they should be able to install it without any problems, really.
Try it, you might like it.
If they can reinstall Windows 7, then they can install Ubuntu.
Yeah.
I think that's a fair assumption. So. And there's no reason why they shouldn't.
Give it a go.
So, I mean... I want to just talk about a little bit just about some of the subtleties in the user interface and some of the other things that are a bit more obscure about the work that's going on in Ubuntu, because there are a couple of different teams that are working with the community that are doing some really good work, and I want to showcase it a little bit. So there's a couple of things you might not have seen. A couple of things here that you can see on the login. Login panel's been shifted to the left, and it's also creating a login and making that available for... John to log in, but below that there's also a guest session that requires no login at all, so anybody coming up to your PC can just use it. You've also got the ability to make choices with a little cog there that allows you to decide whether you just want to use the standard Ubuntu interface or whether you want to use Ubuntu 3D. And also you've got some interface choices on the inside, which I'll talk about when we actually see the Unity interface. But the key things I wanted to focus on at the moment was up in the top right hand corner there by the clock, there's a little man icon, which is the accessibility icon. And there are a couple of things here. So first of all, the on-screen keyboard, which I'm not entirely sure. Oh, the letters are rather small in this particular layout.
I just wanted to say that's fantastic to have that accessibility, and I just
can't see
the 6-point characters is not quite as accessible as I thought the keyboard was going to be.
I'm not entirely sure why it's rendered like that on my little netbook. When I installed it, the on-screen keyboard looked better than that. You've also got the high contrast facility. This, you can change the contrast so that it makes it a bit easier to see things, and also you've got a switch there for the Orca screen reader, which effectively is going to read out things as you're moving the mouse around the screen. So these are blind accessibility things. Now, the thing to say about this is that these developments are in a stock default operating system that you just get from the start of, as far as I'm aware, and I might get shot down any moment by you guys, but I think that these things are pretty unique. I don't think that you get, you know, you can get screen readers for Windows and so on and so forth, but you have to install them, they come as secondary packages and so on and so forth, whereas this is built in at the beginning when you start.
I couldn't say for sure as to whether it's not in the other operating systems. As you say, no doubt you can get them, but if they are there, then I think it's just one of them features that are not ever gone anywhere near. So I don't really have the guns to shoot you down there.
Okay. Well, these features are not complete at the moment, but there is quite a, there's quite a lot of really good work that's being done by the accessibility team. One of the things that that team would really love to get some feedback on from the community is for people to actually play about with those things. Even if you are fully able and fully sighted, play about with the on-screen keyboard, the high contrast. Well, the high contrast is not much there. Mm-hmm. Particularly the screen reader. See what your experience is of that, and perhaps join in with the community. You know, perhaps go and sign up for a Launchpad account, join in with the community, and give some feedback. So the team could be really useful then. So there's a couple of things that I think are kind of a little bit hidden, but are quite unique.
The accessibility is very much following the Mac model, even right down to the little man in a circle. But OS X has features like that that it's been offering for a few years now, I guess. So you got your, you can enhance the contrast.
Yeah.
You can use grayscale. You can change it to white on black. There's voiceover. There's a voiceover feature, which is probably the same as the screen reader,
yeah.
And yeah, I mean, I'd like to think they've done a pretty good job of it in OS X as well. So I'd say this is kind of bringing it on a par with OS X, which is no mean feat, because obviously OS X, you know, Mac pride themselves on making things accessible.
Mm-hmm.
If you've ever accidentally hit the home button 3 times on your iPhone, you notice it starts talking at you. And it's, you know, got some really cool features like that. So, but it's nice to see Linux is bringing itself up to that.
Well, I mean, I've learned something there that I wasn't aware of the accessibility features on the Mac, and I don't use the Mac. I mean, as you guys know, I'm broadly exclusively Linux. I just use Linux for everything, and that's it. So I don't necessarily know those things, but anyway, cool. So let's move on. Moving on from that point, now I've made an arse of myself.
Not at all.
No, not really. But
so I left screen reader on. Hope it doesn't just keep talking at me.
I think this, we can switch it off.
So
look, it won't.
So now I've just logged in. Nice to note the audio works out of the box. Audio works out of the box.
Always a plus.
The Wi-Fi worked out of the box. I guess I was most surprised that the Bluetooth worked out of the box.
Mm-hmm.
So I hooked it up to my keyboard, which is nice.
Have you got it hooked up to that little Apple keyboard?
Yeah,
via
yeah.
Bluetooth.
So
lovely.
And it gains 1 point over the Windows 8 developer preview, because the only thing that was the only difference was that Windows 8 didn't load up my Wi-Fi dongle. I needed to install a driver for that. Surprise, surprise.
Okay.
Whereas obviously Linux just detected it during the install process. So actually,
it just sorted out your wireless dongle straight off.
Yeah. So actually on my hardware, Ubuntu's 1 up on Windows 8 so far.
What graphics card have you got in your box, John?
NVIDIA GTX 260. Don't shoot me down, I know it's old.
No, it's cool. So I suspect that I suspect that that might need the driver updates installing to get full 3D acceleration.
I had a little pop-up that came up. The first time I turned it on.
Yeah, that's what you should get. It should indicate that and tell you that it can install them. And it just gives you a little option to say, would you like to? And you click OK, and it just goes and does it for you.
Yeah, I think it had already downloaded it. That might have been part of the download it did while I was installing.
OK.
It just said, turn it on. So I did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There are some licensing issues to do with Freedom and the kernel. NVIDIA ship a binary only kernel plugin, and so under the GPL you're effectively tainting the kernel by plugging that binary in, so it has to ask you to do that, and also there are some requirements from NVIDIA as a company to sort of make sure that you are aware that you're using their proprietary binary drivers rather than the open source one, so that's why that is as well. You may well find, I don't know if you've tried to play any MP3s, but you may well find the same experience if you try to play MP3s with Banshee.
May
well need to install the codecs. You do it seamlessly.
I've got a feeling it might have done that right at the start. When the install process started up, and this little cog was already there. I'm sure the little audio was there, and Banshee was here. And just out of interest, I clicked play. And at that point, it said, oh, you'll need the MP3 codecs.
And went and got
them. And I said, yes. And I think they were on the disc.
It just needs your agreement for patent legislation purposes. You have to say yes, because they're patent encumbered.
I mean, it didn't bother me, but I did think it was strange that the MP3 player was there during the install process, because obviously there's no MP3s.
No.
But I suppose if I plugged in a memory stick, I could listen to music while it's installing.
Well, let me give you another little cool thing, which is that if you're installing this dual boot, so if you've already got Windows installed, the Ubuntu installer is capable of picking up your Windows files, your Windows preferences, your bookmarks from IE and so on and so forth, because it can look at the disk. And it can equally, of course, access and import your MP3s.
Yeah.
So that enables you there, the MP3 player, if you played that, it will find them on your Windows NTFS partition, and it will enable you to play that material as well, the functionalities in there in a dual boot environment.
Cool. I think this would work best. Actually, one more quick comment that reminded me. I think the bootloader, while fine, isn't as pretty as Windows 8's. the kind of grub bootloader.
Okay.
You know, it's kind of pointless bringing up, but actually it would be nicer if it was a bit more graphical, maybe. Because obviously it's just a text list, and the slightly confusing thing is it had about 8 items on.
Yes, it does, yeah. I mean, depending on what's there, but you'll normally have a couple of kernels. So you'll normally have a fully driver-laden kernel, then a recovery mode kernel, any previous early kernels. So the longer it's on your system and the more it updates, the more of those kernels you'll get. But the grub loader has been smartened up a bit in that it has a previous versions entry now, which is a sub-menu that takes you into a sub-menu.
Yeah.
So it tries to hide some of those things. It then gives you, of course, any Windows partitions that are there and some memory testing diagnostic tools as well, and access to those.
What would be quite cool, I guess, is if it just had, you know, two big buttons at the top, Linux, Windows, and then an advanced button at the bottom, which I could then look at the other partition, the other options if I wanted to.
There is there is something called the Plymouth bootloader that's used on Fedora, and Fedora Linux has that sort of facility. You put it in and it just comes up with a graphical thing and like a progress bar as it boots straight from the outset, which is a bit more shiny. So I know what you're saying. There is the potential there, I think, for users to think that they need to choose something on that menu,
and then
they could get confused. I mean, it's not the end of the world, but I know exactly what you're saying.
It's just a minor... It's nice that we're talking about the minor points now, whereas 5 years ago we'd be talking about the text-based installer.
There, and the fact that you can't get Xorg configured, so you have only got a terminal screen because you can't actually get graphics to work. And your Wi-Fi card's not been detected, and there isn't a driver for it.
And
you can't compile one, and NDIS wrapper doesn't work.
Yeah. Step three of the install, type in CFdisk and do it all yourself.
Yeah.
Have fun. So, but no, it's nice to be talking about the little things. But I think that's one thing. I mean, to be fair, by that point you've already got them because they've installed it. But it would be nice if the first time they rebooted their machine they didn't go, huh? As a Windows user, it's like, what?
It's Tim Allen.
So yeah, I think it probably makes sense if maybe Jack and I have a new user. Yeah, first talk about me and Jack looking at it from kind of a new perspective. Like I say, I've mostly worked with Linux through the terminal and a bit through KDE, but as Ubuntu has got a shiny new interface, it seems, we can talk about that, and then maybe you can look at it from a longevity point of view. How it's evolved from the earlier versions of Ubuntu.
I think that's cool, yeah. I'll shut up for a bit and let's see what you guys discover on the desktop.
I mean, the first thing I notice, especially with it sitting next to the Mac, is that the top bar could have been taken right out of the Mac.
Could be the same, couldn't it, yeah.
No
bad thing. I mean, it's just a sensible layout, isn't it?
I mean, I really like the top bar like that because I think it kind of sucks that you have to have a permanent fixture to the screen, so let's make it as small as possible.
Yeah, that's right. That's right, because that's what you want, isn't it? A little clutter in the place as possible, yeah. I've always thought of it as a decent way to lay everything out.
And it all makes sense. I mean, the Bluetooth, the Wi-Fi, the audio, they're all things you recognise.
This is like, it's just an elementary way to lay out your user interface, isn't it?
This little message chap. I'm sure we'll talk to Rick about in a minute. I see Ubuntu One and Mail, some sort of centralized notification center, perhaps. That's my guess, anyway. And then the cog for system settings.
There they are.
And that's,
I mean, yeah.
That's the Windows control panel, isn't it? That's nice.
Yeah.
That's, again, a far cry from Linux as it was a few years ago.
That's right. I mean, this is all like a polar opposite of what most people's expectations of it are, who don't use it.
So, I guess the next thing to do is to figure out these chaps on the left. So
this is like your,
it's very
like
glossy,
your
that's
dock
that's
on the left.
No,
isn't it?
First impression is that's, this is a good looking desktop.
Yeah, yeah.
This is the OSS dock, OSX dock, I guess, like you said on the left hand side.
Yeah, it looks like the dock.
Firefox being the browser. It's nice and zippy. It's got the Windows 7 feature.
Snapping. Oh yeah, when you like bring it up at the end, it snap. Can you do it to like half a screen, like on Windows 7?
If you can, not by the way I would logically think you could.
I've always thought that was quite a nice feature, the snapping. I mean, the half screen snapping, especially, like, I used to hate it because it was like, oh, let me do it myself kind of thing. Now I realise how foolish I was.
I like the way that operating systems are moving towards this kind of full screen experience. I noticed when I loaded this up, I've got my sidebar, but if I whack it to the top, the sidebar fades away.
Yeah. How do you get it back, by the way, if you want to, oh, it just pops out. Okay. If you go back to it, then it just goes in and out and then tidies itself away. That's nice.
If there's space for it. That's actually really cool because the dock on OS X, I find I do this kind of space on the left and right of the dock is wasted space.
Yeah, exactly.
And that frustrates me.
That's why I started moving my dock to the side, actually, just because I kept accidentally running over icons when I was trying to like click on certain areas. I ended up like catching the edge of an icon and it just got in my way less on the side.
I'm going to have a stab at these other icons.
Stab them.
It tells you to put your mouse over it, but
it takes all the mystery out.
I'm gonna have a stab without the mouse.
Yeah, so we can guess before they come up.
Obviously, we've got kind of the Word, Excel, and PowerPoint equivalents, which the tooltip told me was LibreOffice, which I'm under the impression is the evolution of OpenOffice.
Hopefully it is an evolution as well. I get the impression that OpenOffice itself has just kind of stopped in terms of development. Every time it tells me I've got to like do an update, and this is a complete aside, it says, yeah, there's an update available. Oh yeah, it's French translations every time. So I try and update it just for the hell of it, and it says, oh yeah, update failed. Never mind. So I thought, what's the point?
Well, we could look at that that as a project in a different show, but just to give you a very swift, brief update. Oracle bought Sun Microsystems. Sun Microsystems originally bought a product called StarOffice from a German company, released it open source as OpenOffice. Oracle, when it took on OpenOffice, basically stopped developing it and stopped. And for a long time, there were lots of problems with the open source community patching their code back into OpenOffice. So a new team was forged. Michael Meeks is one of the people that's heavily involved in it. And the new team was called the Open Document Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And they forked the code from OpenOffice and named it LibreOffice. OpenOffice has now been donated by Oracle to the Apache Foundation, and the lead candidate in this space is LibreOffice, which has got a lot more developers and it's really started to ramp up. So if you have got OpenOffice and you're going, oh, what's going on with that? If you just move to LibreOffice, you'll find all those good regular updates with the new features that you were used to are in that now.
So I just need to get off this boat and get on.
Correct, it's as simple as that. It's just moved, the project's just moved.
That's fair enough, yeah.
I won't talk about LibreOffice too much, but it's, you know, it's nice to see kind of Word, Excel and PowerPoint on there from the start.
Yeah.
They've recognised that these are the things you're going to want to do with your PC. Again, whereas before, my Linux install experience was, you put the disk in and it says, are you a server administrator? Here's a list of 4,000 packages. Pick the ones you want.
Yeah, see, that's just... Huh? It's off-putting. It is off-putting because you don't have time. Most people just... Well, a lot of people just don't have time to muck about with that stuff more than once, you know?
Mm.
I mean, maybe the first time, but this is... This, what I'm seeing here, is lovely so far. This is all... the presentation is not shabby in the slightest. It's all really nice, sleek, and not more than it needs to be is the thing. That makes it sound like it's being lazy, but I don't want to give that impression. It's basically, there's not so many bells and whistles that you get the impression it's wasting power. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I know, I always like the stuff with the Mac where it like gets sucked up a Hoover and whatever, but you don't really need it. If it means that Game X is going to run that bit smoother, I'd so much rather get rid of it.
So, something funny going on there.
Oh, that was odd, yeah. It's some weird graphical artifact. Ah, whatever, it's gone now. Forget what you saw there.
It was because the window was sitting back in the compiz shrinked mode, and as you were pulling the mouse over it, X was basically rendering some of the artifacts, and when you clicked on it to bring it back into the main focus. So there's a way to show you this trick a little bit better, which is if you just open up two or three Firefox windows, for example. So if you just like, you know, however you want to do it, open up two or three of them. And then if you then just go and point at the Firefox icon and double click, it should, do that. And it's that kind of out in. It's a feature that Mac has, something very similar as well, that allows you to just basically go, it's, you know, because you could have multiple Office documents open, which one do you want, and it allows you to just like throw them all out like a card deck.
See all your junk on the screen at once to show everything that you've got on the go, sort of thing.
That's kind of part of the new mission control type thing, I'm right.
Correct, yeah.
Cool. I mean, just looking down the sidebar, there's a software center in Ubuntu 1, but I think they sound significant enough that we can have a quick chat about those in a little while.
Sure. What's Ubuntu 1?
Well, Ubuntu 1 is the think Dropbox is the first thing to think.
Yeah.
There are some differences with Ubuntu 1. With Dropbox, what you basically sync Dropbox to a folder and put your files there. Ubuntu 1 does the same thing. Okay, so you can sync, but you can sync multiple folders. You can go through your filing system and say, I want that on Ubuntu 1, this on Ubuntu 1, and Ubuntu 1 will keep them all in sync, sync them up to the cloud. And then you can synchronize that with your devices. So you can sync with your iPhone or Android, and Windows as well. Windows was in beta a few weeks ago, but they've got Ubuntu 1 Gold, which has just been released for Windows. So Dropbox is the way that it works. But to hook this in and make it all tie together, John, you pointed out about some central communication center. One of the things that the Ubuntu team have been working on really well is basically amalgamating everything together. So in your email client and your address book, all of your contacts, etc., all gets synced into your Ubuntu One. So if you're working from different places, all of that gets synced. So you can have all of your contacts and email and those things synced onto your phone using Ubuntu One. Your communication center is absolutely right. You've got chat, you've got broadcast, so on and so forth. Ubuntu One also ties in with Banshee for syncing your music, and so then you can stream using Ubuntu One your music from your PC onto your telephone.
Okay.
So it's all this kind of like, you know, iCloud type of scenario. All of that functionality is there with Ubuntu One. That's what it's doing.
And if, as you say, it's compatible with all these various devices that a lot of people are going to be using. I mean, my first
iOS and Android, which are the primary ones.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's good that it's compatible with the iPhone. My first thought was that I'd quite like something. So I'd like to see alternatives to Dropbox, basically, just to see what they're all like, really, and see if one does the job better than Dropbox does for me currently. But for that, I use the facility on my iPhone quite a lot. If it's compatible with that, then that's something. Well, there'd be a lot of interest in me, definitely.
Yeah,
I think just two more things I want to mention as a new user. One of them is a small thing, but it's nice to see it work out of the box. And that's just I've put in a memory stick with some episodes of CSI on.
Yeah.
Put it in, popped up on the sidebar down here. And by the way, it's given me a preview. I'm assuming it's just going to work. And there we go.
It's an episode of CSI with Edward Furlong, by the look of it. He's looking old.
Yeah, can't complain.
Yeah.
Nice that it just works.
Yeah, awesome.
You'll like it if you plug your iPhone or your iPad into it, because it will drop icons on the desktop for your photos, for your music and your movies. It'll allow you to open them and play them in Banshee and all that kind of stuff.
That's nice to see, a bit of embracing of the other technologies. It says, hey, we're cool with everybody.
Providing it all works, but yeah. I mean, on my little laptop, it does. If I plug my iPad in, up it comes, and there's my iPad stuff. I can get my photos off and all that kind of stuff.
Sure.
It's all synced. It's using LibPodder, I think, which is a. It's. I know. Certainly, you've got one of the most up-to-date operating systems on your iPad, haven't you? So
yeah.
So if it fails, it might be that does it, because LibPod the iPod sync libraries that are open source.
Mm.
Obviously, they're reverse. The guys are reverse engineering Apple's tech. So of course, it's not always right bang up to date. But plug it in and see what happens. So unable to mount John's iPhone. So there's some issue there.
Try him again.
Yeah. So there's some issue there. He'd try it with mine,
that's
John.
That's a bit.
Just a lockdown error.
Try that. Because mine's not as up to date, I don't think.
Give that a go. And we wait. Oh,
yeah.
Here we go.
You've just inserted a medium with digital photos.
There you go. And so now you can see some of my apps installed, the Dropbox app. There'll be some other bits and pieces in there you can get access. There you go. Open audio files in media, in Banshee, and so on and so forth. So I've, for the, both John and I have both got iPhone 4s. But my operating system is not as up to date.
Oh, okay.
And so therefore you can mount that and see my files, etc.
So you're just waiting for these guys to catch up with their.
Yes, they're a few iterations behind.
That's to be expected. I'm impressed it can do it all, to be honest.
Yeah, that's quite cool, isn't it? I guess the only other thing from a new user perspective is this little chap here up in the top left, which I guess. Now I've exhausted the rest of them, I would treat like the Windows start button. And indeed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this lovely arrow effect.
Yeah, I'm assuming I can type in an application name here. And up it comes.
Ding dong. Yeah, and there's Firefox. Yeah, that's good. I'm glad to see that becoming a universal feature as well. The old type name of your application that you want to go in, and up it comes. This is. As long as it's fast.
And you can name of the application or function that you want to do.
Oh, really?
Word processor.
Oh, okay.
Picture editor.
Oh, I'm going to take it that works on keywords.
Correct.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Lovely.
That's
nice. That's good. It's really nice, isn't it?
Yeah. No, that's a.
The other thing to note, which I was quite excited at the way they'd done this as well, is that there are three lines there. You at the top you have your favorite apps, so when you put in if you put browser, for example, it'll show you your favorite apps, the things that you've used the most. Then it will show you what you've got installed, so these things are apps that are installed on the box today that you can use now. Below that, it then shows you a list of applications that suit your match but aren't installed and can be installed just by clicking on them.
Okay, some apps you may like.
Yeah.
Other apps
exactly.
You may enjoy.
Other apps you may like. Yeah, exactly that.
I've got to say, so far, I'm dead impressed with this. I mean, as I've said before, my main worries with an operating system is always the stuff that you can't see, that you can't bring out on a cursory test. You have to use them over a period of time. But Rick can probably, you can probably tell me more about that than this. I mean, how does Linux fare over long term? Is it prone to sort of like getting sticky the way Windows does, or does it just like run consistently well? I mean, how does it perform overall?
I think it certainly does. It doesn't suffer from the inherent problems that Windows does. Windows struggles because of the registry issues and the way the architecture was constructed. Linux doesn't have that problem at all. It's got really excellent package management.
Mm-hmm.
The package manager is quite capable of upgrading, cleaning itself, automatically removing packages, updating packages, and keeping itself in good order. And you don't tend to run into those kind of bloaty slowdown problems. The performance of your Linux box today will not change between now and 5 years' time. So if you installed this now and just let it run for 5 years and didn't, you know, switched off any updates, so it didn't update new software that required more powerful stuff, this would be running at the same performance level in 5 years, which you wouldn't get that from Windows. But having said all of that, I come from a world where Linux was ultra reliable. I mean, we're talking about systems that would run for thousands of days without ever rebooting, restarting, doing everything.
Yeah.
And the desktop experiences have largely been like that up until recent times. In recent times, what's happened is that the development stream has got very rapid, and the amount of development has come on really quickly. Over the last 3 years, Ubuntu's growth in development has been exponential. And so you do tend to get a few more bugs in it and so on and so forth. If you really need rock-solid stability, you can get it with Ubuntu because they have two release mechanisms. They have a six-month release mechanism, the fourth, so April and October, release every 6 months. But it was every 3 years on the desktop they were releasing, every four years on the desktop they were releasing LTS, long-term support releases. The next one is Ubuntu 12.04 in April will be a long-term support release, and I think that's going to be supported for either 4 or 5 years on the desktop. Now, you'll get much higher levels of stability there,
sure,
because your software's not being upgraded to the latest kind of bleeding edges versions. So that's how to approach it. But you can expect the at least equal stability with the Mac. Possibly even more stable.
Sure. That was the one thing I always heard about Linux, is John, you were just to say to me that the government, the American government, used it quite a bit, didn't they, in a lot of their operations, just because of its reliability. I mean, aren't they supposed to use it in the Pentagon, or am I making that up? Have I got that from somewhere?
I don't think I said that, but I wouldn't be surprised if it were true.
Yeah, I'm sure it was something you said once, but it was many, many years ago, and we believed all kinds of things back then.
Well, the whole of Google runs on it.
Oh, really?
So, you know.
It's good enough for Google, I mean.
Yeah. And the greatest majority of all of the top 500 supercomputers in the world all run it now.
Yeah.
Bar a few. There's a few that don't, a few very specialist ones. So, but anyway, I aside off topic and get very excited.
Oh, no, wait. I do remember something else, though. was it the US Air Force? That's right. This was recently. They were running loads of PS3s together.
Yeah.
And they were all running Linux. They were using them all as a Linux supercomputer made of PS3s. So, yes, there is truth to what I said.
Well, here in the UK, the RAF in 2003... built all of their Tornado fighter simulators on OpenSUSE Linux, and all of their sims were done on that.
Sure.
Cracky, majority of the internet runs on it.
Yeah, that's right.
So I guess before we have a poke through the software centre, is there anything you want to say about how it's changed from the previous releases?
Yes, I think that I just want to put a word out there for people who are involved in the Linux and open source community, because there's been an awful lot of rhetoric and quite a lot of negative talk about Canonical, about Unity, this interface that we're looking at today. And I think sometimes the community gets very zealous and passionate about particular projects and almost kind of lays the boot in on things, and the community itself has been giving Unity a bit of a hard time. I think the thing to point out here is that Canonical, still even today, the developers of Ubuntu, they are not telling you that Unity is ready. This is not finished, this desktop experience. The desktop experience project for Unity is due to be finished in 12.04. So the next release in April next year will be the finished product.
Mm-hmm.
So Unity over the last 2 years has gone through a whole bunch of iterations, changing. And that does mean that for users who've been using it for a while, they get used to the keyboard shortcuts and the way the mouse gestures work, and then the next version comes out and they change.
Mm-hmm.
And that's happened again. You know, it used to be that to make that left-hand panel slide in and out, you would just pop your mouse to the top left-hand corner, and the panel would slide in and slide out, almost kind of like a sort of fade-in effect. Now, anywhere on the left-hand side will bring the screen in and out. The keyboard shortcuts were control tab and so on and so forth, but now your meta key, so like your Windows meta key, press it once and you get that keyboard. If you hold it down, you'll get the left hand panel will slide out and it'll put some numbers on it, and so on and so forth. If you hold the Alt and Tab key, it will bring you a scrolling rotator to allow you to kind of page through the windows and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole bunch of tweaks there that have been changed. The little zoom out with the kind of throw all the windows like a deck of cards, yeah, that's handled by the way you click on the buttons in the dock.
Right.
Because you can click and hold the buttons in the dock, which allows you to drag them around and move them. You can right-click them to adjust different parameters, or you can double-click them to throw the cards out. These gestures are taking a little bit of learning, but the thing to say about that at the moment is that pretty much, for new users, the way that you interact with the desktop won't change very much now. It's just a little bit of polish and a little bit of stability. To just iron out a few bugs, yeah, to get a few things, and it'll be really rocking. So it has been a bit of a rocky ride and quite a stormy ride for Unity, but it's settling into a nice desktop experience now.
Well, I certainly found it quite pleasing as a new user.
Cool, cool.
I'm eager to fire up the Software Centre now and see what it has to offer.
Get that Software Centre on the table.
With the OS X App Store proving to be quite popular, and Windows 8 obviously jumping on the bandwagon, it'd be nice to see. I mean, personally, from my perspective, it's nice not to be typing out "get in" all the time.
Yeah.
because I think my problem with Linux hasn't been that's a problem. It's just I always used to go, apt-get this, and it goes, that package needs these 47 packages. Oh. Off you go then, and it did it all for you, but it was a little bit like tedious that every time I wanted something I had to install another 50 things with it. Mm-hmm. So I'm guessing that the Software Centre will still do that, but it's nice that it does it without me knowing.
Well, I think the answer here is drive it, John. Install some stuff. Let's talk about it. I think you're going to be very impressed because this even impresses me, and I take a bit of impressing on Linux these days because I use it all the time.
So I'm going to install, maybe I shouldn't install Eclipse because that's going to be a big old download
Go do it, please do it. It'd be really interesting to see what your reaction is when, because you've already experienced a little bit of backgrounding.
Let's see what this baby can do. Ooh, progress bar, I like progress bars.
Cool, so I set it going and then clicked on more info because... And okay, that sort of person.
So now if you want to go and click on all software up the top, you can leave that now and it'll just do that. And so now go and pick some other stuff and just start adding them in and it'll just queue them all up and install them for you. The derivative, Ubuntu derives from Debian, and Debian comes with 29,000 free software applications for all kinds of different things.
Not gonna lie, I was a little bit upset there.
What was that?
I would like Braid, please. Click one shot, open shot video editor.
Suckers.
Right, okay.
Braid, please.
You fell for the old Braid trap.
That's probably a bug.
Yeah, that's got it to
be.
It
is a bug, yeah.
That's just a goof, yeah. Oh, it says not found for that one. Yes.
Well, the OpenShot is a video editor. I'd love to see what you could do with Blender at some point. It takes a while to get to understand Blender, but it's a great 3D modelling program, and I think you could do some awesome stuff with that, Jack.
I've got a little bit of it's a strange relationship with 3D modelling. I've not really got into it yet. On the occasions where I've dipped my toe in, I found it a little bit frustrating, just 3D modelling in general. Just trying to... get my hands around it, really. I get the impression it's something I could probably have a lot of fun with, but it feels a bit like an uphill battle at the moment. Tremendously interesting subject, though. I suspect I'll get more into it in the future. I should probably have a go at that Blender that you were talking about.
Mm.
But in the past, I think I've found it a little bit difficult to think outside of 2D. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we could take a look at Blender at some point, actually, and have a look at it and talk about it. But the most recent versions from 2.5.9 onwards they completely rewrote the whole user interface and made it pluggable, so it can be skinned in different ways. And so Blender now can be made to perform very much like Maya or other 3D modelling programs that you might already be familiar with that cost thousands of pounds to buy. And Blender, of course, is here. You know, if you say that a modelling program of this calibre is probably $2,500 to buy, and it's coming as a clickable free install on Ubuntu, that's a pretty good offer, I think.
I'm kind of amazed at just how much of this stuff is free, to be honest. I look at it and I'm thinking, surely there's... I mean, how does it all compare quality-wise with a lot of the commercial versions of this kind of stuff? I mean, does it really stand up to all that?
Yes, I mean, I think in fairness, the short answer to that is very often better.
Mm.
I think the reality is that if you are already used to using Illustrator, for example, then you'll come along and get a tool like Inkscape and you'll find that it's a bit of it's not the same, and you'll have all the change issues.
Yeah.
But when you get the change issues out of the way, you'll find that that the two tools are very comparable and very powerful. And I mean, we talked on an earlier show and I mentioned it once, a guy who, you know, developed his design work in Illustrator. I put him on Inkscape, showed him how to use it, and a few weeks later he's come back and said, I would have chosen this tool over that in the first place. This is a designer's tool by designers for designers.
Sure.
I think, you know, that very often the software is just really good.
Mm.
It comes with the stability that you would expect. It comes with the functionality that you would expect. And of course, it's a different piece of software, like Mac software and Windows software is. So it comes with differences. And provided you as a user expect that too, I think your experience will be a pleasant one.
Sure.
I think, I tend to agree. I do want to raise that there are occasions where that isn't always the case. The big one I think I've always had problems with in the past is GIMP. And whatever platform I've used it on, I've always had it crash reasonably frequently. Granted, I haven't used it on Linux for a couple of years, but back when I used to use it on Linux, it was a little bit unreliable. And then you pick up the Windows version to use for some certain, I don't know, because you want to do something and you haven't got access to your Photoshop. And my God, did it crash.
Well, I mean, I can put some meat on the bones, particularly picking on GIMP. GIMP under Windows relied on the Cygwin libraries to be able to run, and the Cygwin libraries were still under development at the time, so it's improved over time. I've used GIMP for 10 years now, and I haven't experienced what you were sort of talking about on the Linux platform. I've always found it really, really stable. In fact, I don't know whether I've ever had it crash, but then having said that, I may well not have used it as thoroughly as you do. What most users tend to say with GIMP is that they've come to GIMP from Photoshop and they simply just can't find the way around it. And it's like, it looks sort of like it's going to do the same job, but the interface is so wildly different that they get completely lost. Nowadays, the GIMP team have done a lot of work on that, so you can get something called GIMP Shop, which is an extension for it, and it turns GIMP effectively into a very similarly laid out application to Photoshop. So, again, you know, just as you were kind of stunned in some ways from your old experiences 2-3 years ago of Linux and then seeing Ubuntu, it's the same with the applications as well. You'd probably find that if you were using GIMP today that you'd probably think, God, this is rock solid.
I think it's unfair sometimes. I mean, people always compare GIMP to Photoshop, and that really bugs me because GIMP can't do everything Photoshop can do. It's not meant to do everything Photoshop can do. So you're not comparing something that's trying to be Photoshop. You know, like, if you said to me, would you rather use GIMP or Photoshop, I'd obviously say Photoshop because it has all these filters and vector shapes and all these features that GIMP doesn't. That's not GIMP's fault. GIMP isn't trying to do those things. If I just wanted to edit images, then I'm sure GIMP would be fine.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in a position where I wouldn't bother. That sounds bad. But because I use Photoshop for these other features, I might as well also use it for photo manipulation. But if I didn't have Photoshop, then I would strongly consider not paying out the £60 for Photoshop Express when GIMP's sitting there.
It's a different tool chain. I mean, if you are a creative, perhaps doing print or web stuff, you're probably going to use tools like Photoshop, InDesign and Illustrator to produce stuff. And those are going to be the tools that you use. And on that tool chain, there's a lot of crossover. There's a huge amount of crossover between Illustrator and Photoshop with vector shapes and so on and so forth. And of course, the blend between InDesign. On the Linux platform, the tool chain is just different. It's GIMP, Inkscape, and Scribus. Scribus is the publishing tool. Inkscape is the illustrating tool for all the vector graphics and everything else. And GIMP provides you with all your picture imagery. So you put those three together, get used to using them, and now you've got exactly the same tool chain, exactly the same power. And I've had a recent experience. In fact, we should get him in and interview him and have a chat with him on one of the shows about this, because I worked with a design guy who is all of that Photoshop stuff. I set up this tool chain for him on an open source desktop. He absolutely loves it now, and he's building a new business called Open Source Design, specifically focusing on saying, I use an open source tool chain to do all my design and targeting open source tools. So the tools are there. Definitely. It's just a case of, like anything, getting familiar with the platform to find them.
Sure.
I don't know if this is a problem with my install or if it's just not available yet, but I know this is no purchasable software yet.
there is something wrong there then. I'm not entirely sure why it's not listing them at the moment, but there should be a whole suite of games in there that you can buy in a similar kind of price range to what you get on the Apple App Store. I mean, if I was to open my little laptop and bring it up now, there's games for £2.49 and stuff like that. So in the purchased software section, it's being fleshed out. I was looking in there for some business apps yesterday. There's an open ERP, enterprise resource planning, so fully fledged business inventory, accounting, financial apps, etc. in there. And I noticed a whole bunch of games that you can buy as well for different things that are in there. So that's just, something's not quite right.
Maybe in a future show we can look at gaming on Linux. That'd be really interesting. I mean, I think there's a really in-depth topic there, but I think maybe first we should just look at what it's like to play games on Linux, because that's the one reason why I haven't moved to Linux, is because I like my games and that's what Windows does.
Yeah, I mean, if I was somebody coming, thinking about Linux coming over from Windows, I mean, where would that lead me with a lot of the programs that I'd be using? I mean, I use things like, obviously, I use Photoshop a lot and Steam and games in general. I mean, for lots of like the little fiddlier programs like Paint Tool Sci and stuff like that, if I wanted to run those in Linux, do I have? Is there any sort of options there? I mean, would I be able, like the smaller programs, would I be able to have a chance of running those in there? Is there any? Can it run any Windows software?
Yes, it can. It can run loads of Windows software. I mean, at the last count, I think WineHQ lists 17,000 or so Windows programs that can be run. Basically, there is an application translator. It's like an interpreting layer that takes Windows system calls and translates them into POSIX or Linux system calls. This is called Wine, which stands for Wine is not an emulator. But basically, load Wine. It also has a few extension libraries that you can plug in to do different things. And there are a few other things to say about it. Standard Wine out of the box will run loads of the .exes, the little, like you talked about, whatever it was, picture sci, image sci, whatever.
Paint tool sci.
There's a good chance that if that's using all of the standard documented Windows APIs, it'll just run, opening a window and off it goes. Very often these things will run. Sometimes you need to do a little bit of tweaking. Then you've got tools like Photoshop. Sadly, Photoshop is one of the pieces of software that the Wine team haven't got running functionally or fully reliable. But things like Office 2010, you can run all of that using Wine. There are also some commercial developers who develop stuff as well. So there is the Sadiga team who develop specific Wine libraries to translate for games. So Windows games, you can get them on Sadiga that will run. And there's also Transgaming, which also have libraries to enable you to if you look at those websites, you'll see what games you can run. But the reality of it is that most stuff you can get to run. Some of the more There's plenty of stuff that won't run.
Yeah.
And you'd expect that too, because they're completely different operating systems. I mean, I take my hat off to the Wine team. They've reverse engineered the Windows system calls and Windows libraries, and put a platform in place that works with all this stuff. It's incredible what they've done. Your other alternatives, of course, are VirtualBox. So you can install VirtualBox on Ubuntu. You can put VirtualBox into seamless mode, load Photoshop on it, and you can have Photoshop open on your Ubuntu desktop and GIMP or whatever else you want, and just move between the two and work like that. So there are ways to work around that to get those very specific tools you need running on the desktop so you can still use them.
Cool. I guess it's probably time that we start thinking about wrapping this up.
Yeah, agreed. I think the short answer to this is go and download the D's distro, get it on a disc, put it in, have a look at the live CD. You're going to be surprised, and very pleasantly surprised, with Ubuntu Linux. It's an awesome offering. Canonical have done a great job.
I mean, I guess my position on it is still, I'll keep it installed. I'll probably try and do some development on it, which is cool. But from a non-geeky point of view, if you're a regular, what I call regular home user, and you just want to browse the internet, do some word processing, maybe do your spreadsheets for your finances, then there's no reason why you shouldn't consider this instead of Windows.
Mm.
Now, obviously, there's no incentive to switch to Linux if you're already using Windows, but maybe the next time you buy a new PC, you consider one of those Acer Evos that's 60 quid less because it's not running Windows. You know, I mean, I don't see any reason why a regular home user couldn't use this to do all that they do at the moment. If you're a gamer or professional, I guess it's going to be a bit harder to move you over. Again, the reason, and there's very little they can do about it until the game market decides to hit Linux. But
and they do in little bits and bobs, but across the board, yeah, it's not.
But I'm not going to lie, I still want to play Battlefield 3 Call of Duty.
Yeah.
and I'm the sort of person who will buy a £300 graphics card to get another 10 frames a second. So if we're going to lose those 10 frames a second by running it under Linux, then that's not an option.
I mean, that isn't always the case. So sometimes you get equal performance, and sometimes better. I've heard occasions where it's better. The reality of it is that, you know, if you're a hardcore gaming platform and you've got it all set up on Windows, why the hell would you change? Only thing I would say is that for professional instances, I've built pretty much most of my career over the last 10 years of doing exactly that, migrating businesses, business users and commercial offerings across to open source, and there are some really good strong reasons for doing that. And people think that that's a new thing, but you know, I took a 30-people company to Red Hat Linux in 2001. It was 100% open source installation, no Windows at all on the premises, and that system was put in place and it ran with 30 workstations on it for over 1,000 days without a reboot or a crash, and that was back in 2001. So you know, it's there, it's out there. Go get it.
I think, just to clarify my last point, by professional, I guess I didn't mean business, which is obviously what it does mean. I just meant if you are a Photoshop user or a narrow field specialist, then maybe it's not time. But I think for the wider business, it's the perfect excuse to save a few £1,000 on computers. You know, if your workers are going to be browsing the internet, writing documents, which, let's be honest, kind of 80% of office staff probably do that, there's no reason to pay out for Word and Windows and all the support that it requires.
No, sure.
Just get yourself a Linux expert and just install this.
Yeah.
Well, I've got to let us know what you think. Get in touch with us, show@random.org, or, of course, tweet us, @randompodcast, with an @ in front of it. I think we can outro this evening with something a little bit random, seeing as we're a bit random, so we'll pass that over. I've really enjoyed talking about this. This is right up my street, guys. Thank you ever so much for giving me the opportunity to chat about this at my heart's content. I get very excited. I've been Rick Timmis, Have a great evening. Goodbye, everybody.
I've been John Wordsworth, putting this hour of Linux to bed.
And I'm Jackson Matthews, and this is not your daddy's Linux.
At random. No one would have believed that in the early years of the 21st century, human affairs were being watched from the timeless worlds of space. Few men even considered the possibility of life on other planets. And yet, across the gulf of space, minds immeasurably superior to ours regarded our world with envious eyes.
Hiya lads, it's Jerry, Mank Techie coming back at you on the planet. How's it going? Yeah, all right. Totally what? Wicked, eh? Check it out. So, what have I been doing this week? Well, I've been getting up to try to do a bit of training, like, you know, and just totally, it's mental, man, absolutely mental, try to teach people stuff. They just don't take nothing in, man. It totally smashes me Sweden. Try to show people how to do stuff on the computer. Everybody just seems to be, they really struggle with it, you know what I mean? As a country that's supposed to be first world, it's just mental trying to get people to use stuff. I find it really frustrating. I don't think training's really for me. I'm better back in server cabinet, you know what I mean? Anyway, lads, so I've come back on shore to do another Magnatune track for you. So this week I'm going to introduce a next track that's coming up for you, and I'll do that just in one moment. But I just wanted to let you know that Mrs. Techie's getting on fine with Ubuntu, and we just done another install of that, so updated it to Ubuntu 11.10. Oneric Ocelot. What in hell's name's that? I don't know any idea what an ocelot is at all, but that's just, you know, totally mashed me melon. Anyway, lads, here we go, over to another track from Magnatune. Here it is.